מטאוורסים פלטפורמה, הפודקאסט של אורי ורן, התוכנה ועוד. שלום, ברוכים הבאים לפודקאסט מספר 331 של רוורסים פלטפורמה. בפרק הזה אני מארח את רנדי לפודקאסט על Data Science Experimentation at Scale. בנקודה הזאת אנחנו נעבור לאנגלית. Hi again and welcome to Rוורסים. Randy, it's good to have you here.
Thank you. Yeah, great to have you. Great to be with you.
Cool. So, if you'd been to Rוורסים Summit, you probably have met Randy. He was the keynote speaker on day 2 at Rוורסים Summit. Randy spoke about the topic of moving fast at scale. I highly recommend watching the video, and it's going to be on the podcast as well as an MP3 recording. So this was a great session. So thank you again, Randy. Randy is a long-time engineer and engineering lead with history at companies, at startups as well as bigger companies such as eBay, Google, Stitch Fix, and right now he's the VP of Engineering at Stitch Fix. Before we move on to our topic today, which is data science and experimentation at scale, I would like to hand you the virtual mic, and tell us a little bit more about yourself, Randy.
Oh, great. Yeah, thanks. I'm the VP of Engineering at Stitch Fix. So Stitch Fix is probably unfamiliar to Israeli listeners because we are not yet in your country. But Stitch Fix is a clothing retailer, and we use a ton of data science and engineering to figure out the clothes that people would like. And maybe as we talk more about data science, I'll talk a little bit about how Stitch Fix works and how data science is a part of it. But I've been at Stitch Fix for 2 years, and I run essentially the internal engineering organization. So that is all the engineering about applications that we use internally at Stitch Fix. And then I have a partner in crime who runs the sort of externally facing, consumer facing parts of the engineering group. But before Stitch Fix, I was sort of a roving CTO as a service, as my friends used to say. I would help companies try to move fast at scale along the lines of the keynote that I gave at Rוורסים. And before that, I worked at Google as director of engineering for Google App Engine. So that's Google's platform as a service. And then earlier in my career, I was chief engineer at eBay, and I worked there for about 6.5 years, mostly on eBay's search engine infrastructure. So lots of really interesting problems there, and actually some relevant data science problems too.
Cool. So you mentioned Stitch Fix. You mentioned that you're basically a retailer of clothing. But I don't know if you mentioned that you do this algorithmically, and that makes the story a whole lot more interesting, I think.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, great. So that now's the time to tell how Stitch Fix works. Mm-hmm. So Stitch Fix is sort of the reverse of a standard clothing retailer. What do I mean? So rather than coming and shopping on Stitch Fix's site, what if you had an expert to do it for you? So what if you had an expert to choose your clothes for you? And that's Stitch Fix. So you come to the site, you sign up for Stitch Fix, and you fill out a really detailed profile about yourself. So your size, your height, your weight, your age, the kinds of styles you like, the things that you wouldn't wear, your price preferences. Do I like to flaunt my arms? Do I like to hide my hips? Like all sorts of really detailed information about yourself. And we ask all those things because if you think about it, if there's somebody in your life that knows how to choose clothing for you, so maybe that's you, or maybe it's a spouse or a sibling or a best friend, what does that person know about you? And those are the kinds of questions that we ask. So you fill out that really detailed profile. You will get in the mail 5 handpicked items, handpicked for you personally by an actual person. And then you open, the box and you try those 5 things on, and you keep the things that you want, and you will, pay for those, and then you return the other ones for free. So this model only works, this works basically if we are able to guess what you will like. And so there are two components to that. The first is a algorithmic or data science component, and the second is the human component. So every day we take all of the inventory that we have, and we look at all of the clients that we have, and we basically compute a predicted probability of purchase. What is the conditional likelihood that if we send Randy this particular shirt, that he will keep it, right? So maybe 65% chance for, you know, some particular shirt, and 57% chance for some jeans, and I don't know, 42% chance for some shoes, something like that. And those are obviously personalized recommendations, personalized scores for me and for that particular piece of clothing. And then we surface those personalized recommendations to one of 3,500 human stylists, we say. So the stylist is an actual person, usually a woman, that chooses the clothes, the actual five items that are going to get sent to me in that box. And so we are sort of augmenting or empowering her by going through all the data that we have about me and about our other clients and about our inventory to figure out what things we might like. And so our idea is that we try to use the best of the machines plus the best of the humans, right? We use the machines for what the machines do best, which is computing these algorithmic scores, and we use the humans for what the humans do best, which is, you know, putting together an outfit or answering a particular request I might have, because maybe I'm going to a wedding or I want a business casual thing to wear to work or something to wear on the weekend, you know. So the humans are really good at those things, where the machines are not yet good at those things.
So first of all, this sounds like something I just need to have here in Israel, because if there's anything I hate is shopping for clothing. So this sounds like very, you know, very useful service for me. But I just wonder, I mean, it sounds like almost an NP hard problem. So, I mean, how difficult is it to find the right clothing for any old person? I mean, if I just go on, fill in a form, answer some questions, which I did, by the way, just out of curiosity. Not that it's going to work for me as well. But, I mean, how difficult or how successful are you at actually doing this and making money out of that?
Yeah, I'll answer that in several ways. So the first is, how successful are we at guessing what you like? And so you can imagine that there's sort of a network effect here, because the more people that join, the more we learn. So the more that we can learn about you, the better we can predict what you will like. Okay, so every time you interact with us, we're learning more about you, right? So every time we send you a box, you keep some things, you return others, you tell us why. So you tell us, did it fit well? Was it good quality? Was the sizing right? Was the price good? And you tell us all those things, and we improve our knowledge about you over time. But that's also true. But even if you do nothing, we are learning more about everybody else in our sort of ecosystem, if that makes sense, right? So as other people are getting their boxes and keeping things and returning things, we are learning more about other people that are like you. And so we can make better predictions and recommendations for you, even if you don't do anything. So, okay, so I'll just say that. That's like the general, like, that's the intuition about how over time it can get better. We do absolutely draw the line, and I'm sort of gesturing with my hands now. We draw the graph of what was our predicted likelihood of your keeping it, and what was the actual likelihood, you know, what did you actually keep? And you want that to be a straight line, right? You want, if we say 50% chance, we want that to be 50% of the time somebody kept it and 50% of the time they didn't. And it turns out that we're pretty darn good at that. And so that line is very close to straight. So over time, we've been able to make those predictions better and better. Mm-hmm. And so the other question, I mean, I'm happy to go into detail on all these things, by the way, but the other thing you mentioned...
You mentioned numbers such as 40%, 50%. Are those good numbers for you? I mean, is 50% enough to send the clothes to somebody, or are you looking for 90 or 99%?
Yeah, that's not, I think that's touching on some proprietary things I can't really share, but But thanks for, I mean, it's a legitimate question. I just can't answer it. I will say that over time, well, so we don't expect it to always be 100%. Does it make sense? Like, that would be unrealistic.
Yeah, of course.
And obviously we don't have much of a business if it's always zero. Do you know what I mean? Like, if we can't find anything for you, you know, that's a problem for the business. And so I guess I will answer this in a somewhat indirect way, which answers another part of your question, which was how well does the business do, is the business doing?
I think it's easy to imagine the equation. I mean, there's the money that the delivery cost, there's the money that the clothing costs, and there's the gap, and you need to be, you know, positive at that. And, you know, that's basically the equation, right? And so I assume that it goes pretty well.
Yeah. So the, yeah, like you say, the ultimate business model. So, I mean, I talked about a fancy way to make the business model work well, but the ultimate business model is exactly any clothing retailer. Like, so we buy the clothes at wholesale prices and we sell it to you at retail prices. And that delta, you know, that difference is where we make our money. So, I mean, that insight is perfectly correct. And it just turns out that we deliver those clothes to you in a different way than most retailers, right? Instead of walking into a store or shopping, you know, online, instead, you know, we send it to you in a different way. But ultimately, the economics of the business are the same. Like, we wanna you know, buy low and sell high. But like you say, there's the shipping cost. There's obviously the, you know, the purchase cost of the clothing. We have to house it in our warehouses. We have to pay our employees. And then we also have shipping costs both directions. You know, if you decide not to keep everything, some of it's going to come back and we have to, you know, we have to pay for that shipping cost. But the other thing that's interesting is because we are able to have a more personalized service and because people are able to try it on at home, we have so far not had to discount the clothing in a way that, at least in the United States, most clothing retailers are having to do. So I'm not sure how this is in Israel, but in the United States, traditional clothing retailers are not doing well at all, and they're really having a difficult time. And so their model is like making the clothes cheaper and cheaper and cheaper by selling them, you know, continually selling them at a discount. And so far, you know, knock wood, we have been able to maintain a model where people like the convenience of the service and being able to discover things that look great on them without a lot of effort, you know, on their part, and maybe discover, not maybe, but absolutely discover new things that maybe they never would have tried on in the store, but they love.
Yeah.
So just super briefly, the two things that we hear, because most of our clients are women, we traditionally have been always a women's business, and then we now started doing men over the last year. So we have way more women's clients than we do men. So the two things we hear often from our women clients are A, oh my gosh, I've never had jeans that fit, and finally you have found me jeans that fit. And those are why we ask all those detailed questions, because you know, we have maybe hundreds of different kinds of jeans that we can find, and we can find stuff that fits perfectly. And the other one is kind of what I was mentioning, is a bit the sort of serendipity idea, or the surprise idea, where, you know, you sent me this dress or this blouse that I never would have tried on in the store, but it looks gorgeous and now it's my favorite, you know. So that's the other kind of thing that we hear.
And when a customer decides to return the clothes, do they need to specify the reason for not liking them? I mean, is it a size or a taste or something else?
They can. I mean, they can return things for no reason, but we make it really easy as part of the process when we say check out, you know, so when you're deciding to keep, you know, several of the things and maybe return others, we make it really easy to just check which did you like the price? Did you like the size? Did you like the fit? And hopefully you like them all. But if you decided not to keep something, we want to hear why. And again, as you can imagine, that's exactly the learning part of the machine learning, right? Yeah. So the data scientists need as much of that information as they can get. I mean, it's already the strongest thing is you didn't keep it, right? That's the strongest signal, but a slightly weaker, but also very important set of signals is around why you didn't keep it.
All right. So I think we get more or less how the business works and how the algorithmic side, I mean, the general picture of what are the boundaries of the algorithmic side. And And the topic of this podcast is data science and experimentation and scales. So could you say a few words about the scale of things right now?
Yeah, sure. So I'll answer that in a couple of different ways. So I guess I'll answer it first from a very selfish engineering or self-centered engineering way. So when I joined 2 years ago, we had 25 engineers, and now we have 125. Mm-hmm. And then in addition to those 125 engineers that are building the website and building all the applications that we use, we also, in addition, have 80 data scientists. So in addition to 125 engineers, we also have 80 data scientists. And we apply those data scientists to every problem that we have. So the obvious one is making those personalized recommendations. So a plurality. So the largest, you know, subset of those 80 work on various aspects of that problem. But we also have data scientists that are working on what clothes for us to buy. So that's called merchandising. Mm-hmm. We also have data scientists that are working on predicting customer demand, data scientists that work on optimally routing the people picking those five items in your box, optimally routing them through the warehouse, because that's a traveling salesman problem. So, you know, again, that's amenable to data science and to algorithmic heuristics, at least. So we use those 80 data scientists against every problem. So that's one aspect of the scale. That's sort of maybe the engineering or the technology part of the scale. Overall, we have roughly 6,000 employees. So 3,500 of them are these stylists, you know, that choose what goes in the box. Roughly 2,000 of them, more or less, are people that work in our warehouses all around the United States. And then maybe 600, the numbers don't quite add up, but roughly 600 people are sort of full-time employees. And those include the engineers, the data scientists, you know, the merchandisers that buy the clothes, all that. Mm-hmm. And then the other aspect of scale, which we can talk about, is sort of the business side. So as I know you know, but why would your listeners all know, we recently became a public company as of middle of November. And so now we have to and can talk publicly about the business. And so we were just under $1 billion of clothing sold last year. So I forget the exact number, but I want to say roughly maybe $970 million, something like that, close to, but not yet, $1 billion. And that's mm-hmm. how much clothing that we sold last year. And so I don't know this exactly because I haven't looked up myself, but I want to say that puts us in the top 10 online clothing retailers in the United States. I believe I heard that somewhere. Mm-hmm. So from the perspective of, I guess, impact on the market, in the United States, it's a big deal. So, you know, other retailers are thinking about our entrance into the market, and we're sort of a disruptor. And, you know,
mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. So you mentioned that for every two data scientists, there are about three developers, which is not very common in a lot of companies. So that's one interesting aspect. And the other aspect is that a lot of your business depends on this data and this science, because, you know, I think, as you mentioned before, 3,500 stylists is just not enough for choosing clothes for that many customers. So data science has its own challenges, and I just wonder what special challenges on top of that, I mean, on top of just, you know, doing data right and doing the science right, what other extra challenges are there when you deal with those things at scale? So, I mean, generally speaking, scale is good for data. The more data you have, the better science you have. But so that's the good thing. The bad things, or maybe the challenges, are doing these things at scale. And I was hoping you could tell us a bit about those challenges.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I'll talk about that in a couple of different ways. But yeah, you're right. I guess I'll start just briefly echoing the thing you said, which is that ratio between engineering and data science is, I think, unique in the world. I'm very happy to meet the company that has that kind of near one-to-one ratio, but I have not yet met it. It certainly is. There's nobody in e-commerce or retail that does anything near our commitment to data science. And we know that because we know all those companies. But I suppose it's possible that there's, you know, a hedge fund or some kind of financial company that sort of has that ratio between the data science side and the engineering side, and that would be legitimate. But at our side, even at that scale of company, you know, the several hundred engineers and data scientists put together, we're not aware of any company that has our same commitment to data science. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what are the challenges at scale? There's moving all the data around. And so we have a chief algorithm officer, you know, parallel to our chief technology officer that runs the engineering side. Our chief algorithm officer runs the data science group. And that data science group is sort of seeded, and it continues to be led by a bunch of people that worked on data science at Netflix. And mm-hmm. so the guy that runs the platform team, we call it, over on the algorithm side, has built and maintained large scale infrastructures for data at, you know, Stitch Fix, but also at Netflix. The idea is to make it as easy as possible for the data scientists to be productive. And so they correctly need a sort of higher level of abstraction than one would imagine on maybe an engineering side. But also their problem is somewhat a bit more constrained, if that makes any sense. So the model that the algorithm platform offers to the data scientists is essentially write in Python or in the R language a thing that takes a matrix and produces a matrix. Does it make sense? So there's mm-hmm. a matrix in, yep. and you do some transformation on it, and then there's a matrix out. Mm-hmm. And now then conceptually, and actually, we stitch together those kind of units of computation into a larger computational graph that we flow data over. Does that mm-hmm. conceptually make sense? So we're flowing data over this whole graph of computation. So I can talk a little bit about some of the special things that team has done to make that easy for the data scientists. Mm-hmm. But to take a step back and talk about the infrastructure there, which we're very open about. So we make very heavy use of Spark, mm-hmm. which has exactly this computational model of modeling the entire, you know, set of transformations that you want to do as this computational graph, and then caching along the way in the appropriate ways. So we make really heavy use of Spark. Mm-hmm. And we also use a ton of off-the-shelf analytics technologies. Basically, if it exists in the market, we use it somewhere. So we use Hadoop and Hive and Presto and Amazon Redshift. I'm sure I'm forgetting a few, but each of these have their kind of pluses and minuses and are good for some use cases and, you know, not for others. And so where these things are appropriate, we use them. Mm-hmm. And then I guess now I'll come to the model for the data scientists. So I mentioned that they mostly write in Python, but some like to write in R, and their model is simply, have this function, you know, essentially that, takes a matrix and produces another matrix. And it's the job of that algorithm platform team to get the data in there and to get the data out of there. And so the data scientists actually build and deploy their own code. So in some models of data science, there are the data scientists that write the algorithm conceptually, and then they have a software engineer sort of put it into code, and we don't have that duality. So the data scientists write their own algorithms, and they actually do DevOps, where we say, mm-hmm. I like to say AlgoOps. So they, that's my new term. The algorithm platform guys are like, it's just DevOps. I say, yeah, but AlgoOps sounds so cool. The data scientists are operating their own, they do their own deployments, just like we do on the engineering side. And if one of their models, you know, doesn't run, they're the ones that get paged, and they're the ones that fix it. And so this, mm-hmm. the platform that the algorithms team has built allows them to do that. So they write their thing in Python, for example. The deployment pipeline wraps it in a Docker container and deploys it to the Amazon Elastic Container Service, and then hooks it up so that the right data, you know, gets there and goes through there. So maybe I'll just pause. Happy to talk about more any of those in detail, but I'll maybe just pause and see where you want to go.
Right. So the first thing to notice is that you have data scientists carrying pagers, which is something that isn't very familiar to a lot of companies. So yeah. That's one. By the way, did you say that you also run R in production, or is it just Python?
My understanding, so this is not, that's not my area, to be perfectly frank. I know the vast majority is in Python, but I do believe there's a bunch of stuff in production in R. But again, the way that this model works is that it breaks down, you know, the overall model is lots of these little transformations, you know, all stitched together. And it's, you know, it's perfectly legit to have those individual transformations be written in any language. And that's the beauty of the, you know, the container model and the Spark approach and, you know, all those things, like the individual sort of nodes, if you like, in that computational graph can be written in any language.
Yeah. So my question is, I'm sure you're familiar with the topic of continuous deployment. And one of the things that that is highlighted is that the feedback loop is very short. So a developer commits code, and maybe a few minutes later, users use this code and the developer gets feedback, whether it crashed, whether it worked correctly, whether the conversion went up, down, etc. So I'm just curious, in terms of data science, how close or how small is this feedback loop for the data scientist? I mean, you know, they code an improvement in the algorithm and then wait for how long to see if it works?
In a typical scenario. Yeah, no, that's great. And the answer is there are several different feedback loops on different time cycles. And I'll say what I mean by that. So, but you got it. First off, you got the general idea. So we, on the engineering side, we practice continuous delivery, but and DevOps. And we at Stitch Fix, we also on the algorithm side or the data science side, we also practice continuous delivery and we also practice DevOps or AlgoOps, like I was saying. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the deployment feedback, that happens in order minutes, right? So like, you know, we decide to deploy something, it goes through a bunch of tests, and then it gets deployed. Some models are running continuously in a streaming sort of model, and other streaming approach, I guess I'll say, and other models run sort of only hourly or daily, so on a periodic, like more mini-batch style. So, you know, if your thing is running, let's imagine once a day, you can wait for one day, you know, and your thing is going to run. And then you can see. So that's, you know, that's sort of the next level of feedback. And then the larger level of feedback would be I'm running a new experiment. And I haven't talked about experimentation, but I happily will. I'm trying to build the next version of the algorithm. So I'm going to run, you know, the current version, all the data through the current version, and I'm also going to run all the data through my new version, and then I can compare what the predictions I would have made, you know, with the new version versus the old one, and see what the difference would be. And so that feedback loop, the feedback of how long it takes for me to get essentially the experimental results, that has more to do with accumulating an amount of data that is the appropriate sample size so that I can make statistical inferences than it does about anything having to do with continuous delivery. Does it make sense what I'm saying? So the continuous delivery makes it possible for me to deploy quickly, but that doesn't magically mean that this experiment that I'm making this up, but this experiment that I'm running on 1% of traffic, like that still might take a while, maybe days or weeks to accumulate enough data and enough essentially signal or enough, you know, a sample in order for me to be able to detect small differences. And as you probably know, and I'm sure your listeners would know, if I want to detect a very large change, it doesn't take me much time to do that or much sample. But if I want to detect a very subtle change, like I've made a very subtle improvement in the personalized recommendation in one of the models, it might take me quite a long time to accumulate enough sample to be able to detect a, you know, like 0.1% improvement in our prediction. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I remember from my own personal history is that testing data or testing algorithmic changes is always challenging. And as far as I remember, there always used to be two different approaches. One of them is percent testing that you mentioned, and the other is shadow testing. So, for example, you take the entire data set and you run it for production as usual, and also a shadow copy of that with a new algorithm, and then you compare. So you did mention that you're doing percent experiments, and I just wonder if you ever, you know, thought about the shadow testing approach, and if you have any feedback on that.
Yeah, I mean, both of those are sort of tools in your experimental toolbox. If you want to actually show it to a person, you have to do the percentage test,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
In other words, if you need the client, and we say client. So, if you need the client's feedback, which is true of any aspect of our recommendation model, then you actually do need to hold out some percentage in an experiment group, or maybe several experiment groups or treatment groups, and then another in a control, and you do it as a very disciplined statistical experiment. But before we get to that point, I hadn't heard the term shadow, but I know what you mean. We do that kind of shadow experimentation where we run the other thing in parallel, and then we see what we think the difference might be or might have been if we showed it to real people. And that's a sort of additional step along the way to being making us feel comfortable that this might be a thing that would be better for clients to try. Mm-hmm. Does it make sense?
Yes, it does. Now, regarding percent experiments, both of us used to work for Google, and we know that if there's a new feature, you launch it. You do. First you run a percent experiment, and you launch that experiment, and pretty soon you see results in terms of probably minutes and maybe hours. But in the case of Stitch Fix, this could be in some cases days, right? Because you need to send the merchandise to the clients and get the look at the number of returns, look at their feedback, and sometimes those percent experiments could take a while. Now, I suppose you don't want to do just one experiment at a time. You run multiple experiments at one time, and you need to somehow control that. So that looks like a pretty complex system. Keep everything, keep all experiments on one hand segregated, on the other hand run them in parallel. So did you write your own system for that? How challenging is this really, is this in reality?
Yeah, no, absolutely. That sort of so you ask several questions. You ask, do we run multiple experiments in parallel? Answer, yes. So mm-hmm. We're constantly running experiments on all aspects of the business, all in parallel. And sometimes those things are sort of independent of one another, in which case we don't have to worry about it, right? So struggling for the example, but experiments that we're running on what things to buy for the next season, like that doesn't influence experiments that we run on the checkout user interface. Like those things are independent of one another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so we are constantly running experiments, and as you say, we are often, even in one experiment, we might have several treatment groups, right? So we might have one control, but we might be testing several different variants of an algorithm mm-hmm. At the same time. Yes, also true. And so then what you were suggesting, which is correct, is that when there are cases when these experiments might, in some sense, overlap with one another, like do you have to unpack that? And yes. And so sometimes we unpack that by trying not to do it, like we try to keep the experiments separate, where we would maybe run one major experiment at a time in one particular area of the site, if that makes sense. That's something mm-hmm. that we might do. There are a bunch of statistical techniques around multivariate testing, where you're actually trying to test two different variables at the same time. And we absolutely do that as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm a bit curious about the history. How did you end up with this methodology? Did you just start like that, or did you start with something much simpler and then over time developed this? The reason for asking is that suppose I have a company that does a lot of data, but it's not as big as Stitch Fix. Do I need to use the big guns at the beginning, or are there steps along the way to go there?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, by asking the question, I think you know the answer, but and you already do know the answer. I love this quote, and I forget who said it, but it's any complex system that works started out as a simple system that worked. Our approach to data science is exactly that way. So, you know, we started 6 years ago, and we were running, you know, small sets of experiments on the relative, you know, much smaller client base that we had at the time. And then we have gotten more and more sophisticated and added more data scientists and more, you know, parallel experiments and more parallel models. So, yeah. So somebody who has is listening to this podcast and sort of wants to get started in data science, like, don't start with multivariate experiments, you know, straight away. Start with something that's very simple. And then sort of build up from there. Mm-hmm. So, we did the same.
Yes. But I would assume that also a good tip would be to start right from the get-go, start having data scientists write production code and carry pagers. And, you know, this part of the process, I think, is healthy right from the get-go.
That would be my recommendation. Stitch Fix has taught me a lot in many ways. And it's the first time I've worked with data scientists a lot. And it's the first time I've worked with this kind of algo ops or DevOps concept for data science. And I'm a huge, you know, but why would your listeners know? Like, I'm a huge believer in DevOps model for engineering. And what this has now taught me is that engineering and data science are very similar in this way. And so the exact same techniques, sort of, you know, agile or DevOps techniques that work for engineering also work for data science. And what's the only thing that's weird about it is that, it's not that it's weird, it's just that it's new. So most data scientists are not used to yet working in an environment like that. But just like engineers, once you show them how the model works, how the way of working works, they're very excited about it. And why do they like it? It's because they have control of their own destiny, right? They don't have to wait for the engineer to turn their algorithm into code and some other operations person to deploy it and some other, I don't know, data engineer to look at get the data for them. Like, it's all directly in the control of the data scientists, and they love that. A lot of the data scientists are former PhDs in, you know, astrophysics or biochemistry or mm-hmm. experimental psychology or something like that. And they're used to running their own stuff. Like, they're used to being very scrappy and, you know, in their academic career, doing all that stuff. And so it's just a direct sort of transfer of the things that they used to do to get their doctorate.
Actually, I didn't think of it this way, but it does make a lot of sense. So this is all very interesting, and we're getting close to the end of the podcast. So just wanted to make sure, is there anything else that you wanted to mention on that topic? Because we still have a few minutes.
Yeah, so I guess I wanted to echo the thing that you said a moment ago, which is putting myself in the shoes of somebody of a company maybe that's just getting started with data science. I guess I would say several things. Yeah, I would say, number one, you can never have enough data, right? You always are going to want to be collecting a very detailed set of the behavior of your users, even if there are things that you're not entirely sure how you'll use. If it's something that one of your customers is doing, like, it's really interesting to know that. And the data science, I've never heard a data scientist say they have enough data or too much data. They always want more because there are more things that they can learn. So that's number one, is always collect a ton of data and retain it forever. And, you know, data is really, you know, retaining data is pretty cheap, you know, in the cloud. So that's a thing that I would strongly recommend. And yeah, to echo your other point about applying the same kind of, you know, agile or DevOps model to data scientists, that's also really powerful. And again, it has that nice benefit of giving the ownership and the power directly to the data scientists to do everything that they need to get the data that they want and transform it appropriately and, you know, turn it into business value. And then I guess mm-hmm. the third and maybe last thing is again, the thing that Stitch Fix has taught me is data science is so powerful and it can be applied to everything. You know, if you have any interesting business problem that you don't know the answer to, data science is a way of helping you figure out what new things that you can try. And one of the great things about our model at Stitch Fix that I really enjoy is every time we're building something new, we always have the sort of business component, you know, somebody from the business side or a group that, you know, wants us to move a particular business metric. And then we have the engineering side where we're going to build the tools and the applications and improve them. And then we then what's new for us or new to me as part of us is there's now this also this data science side as well. So that kind of tripartite, three parts of business and engineering and data science all solving problems together. And that's just been so much fun for me.
Cool. So Randy, this had been, again, a great pleasure. I'm looking forward to having you again in Israel and having Stitch Fix as a service in Israel as well. maybe you'll bring it with your next flight over here. So thank you again for talking to us, and I'm looking forward to seeing you again.
I look forward to seeing you too.
Bye bye.
All right, take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.